Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Turn to Exodus 24. We should be able to make some real progress. I know the last several weeks there's been a fair amount of redundancy. I know the last several weeks there's been a fair amount of redundancy. Tom, was that far ahead of me? Anyway, I know the last several weeks there's been a lot of redundancy. And I've been repeating myself in a redundant fashion. Just because we've been driving home a couple of points that I just want to be real clear, real didactic about, because there is so much confusion about what position the law ought to hold on the conscience of a blood-bought Christian. So I think by now you understand my position and you understand where I derive that position from and why I am committed to saying the law is a covenant made with Israel that is not binding on especially Gentile Christians. Now, we're going to see more of that language tonight, but I won't have to really pound it tonight because I think by now we've got the framework. But we're going to see a reference tonight to the Book of the Covenant. There's going to be blood sprinkled, and it's going to be called the Blood of the Covenant. And God's going to tell Moses that he's going to give him some laws that he's going to put in a box called the Ark of the Covenant. So that language keeps coming up. And then by the time we get to the high priest and the office of high priest, and Aaron is specifically chosen out to be high priest, we're going to find that he goes in to mediate between God and particular people. He goes in to mediate between God and Israel. So when we get to that, we're also going to talk about the office of high priest and the particularity of a high priest. Nowhere in the Bible do you find a high priest who universally goes in to mediate or to redeem everybody on the planet. High priest is always a very specific function. And so that's why it's so important that in the New Testament, the writer of the book of Hebrews, himself a Hebrew writing to Hebrews, uses the language of high priest and says Christ is our high priest. And so any Hebrew listening to that language is going to recognize the particularity of the office of high priest. So Moses is going to go up on the mountain. He's going to take the 70 elders with him right here at the beginning of chapter 24. God's going to tell him, bring the 70 up. The 70 are going to get a vision of God, but only Moses is going to get to go talk to God. And now God is going to move past rules and laws, and he's going to move into the building of the tabernacle in the wilderness. And he's going to start describing the furniture, and he's going to describe it in great detail. And then he's going to describe how you're going to use the furniture, and then who can use the furniture, and how you build the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and then who's allowed in the tent of meeting, and then the holiest place within the tent of meeting, and who's allowed to go in the holiest place, and when they're allowed to go into the holiest place, and what they have to be wearing when they go into the holiest place, what they have to bring with them when they go into the holiest place, what sort of incense is burning when the guy wearing the right clothes with the right sacrifice goes in on the right day to the place of meeting in the holiest place. God's real, real particular about all this stuff, which again tells us something real important about God, which is that from God's perspective, God's attitude is that God gets to set the rules about who approaches him and how they approach him. What is the means by which you approach God? Nowhere in the Bible is that left open and vague. Nowhere in the Bible do you get the impression that God is just sitting up there in heaven waiting for folks to approach him, and when they come, anyway is good as long as they come. You never get that impression. You hear that a lot in religion where they'll say, well, there's one God and many pathways to God. You certainly don't see that in the Bible. He says, okay, now all of Israel stay at the bottom of the mountain. This is right at the top of chapter 24. Everybody in Israel stay down there. Moses, come up and bring 70 of the elders with you. Now the 70 elders can come up this far, no further. Now, Moses, you come up the rest of the way. God's real particular about who gets to approach him. Nobody in Israel, you could be an Israelite, descendant of Abraham, member of the tribe of Zebulun, and live and die your whole life a few feet from the outer wall of the tabernacle in the wilderness. But you could never go in it. You weren't allowed in it. Now the tribe of Levi was required to go in it. They had to go in and do the service inside there. And while they did the service inside the tabernacle, they could come within feet of the holiest place. But they couldn't go in there. Only Aaron and the succession from Aaron of high priest could ever go in the holiest place. But not whenever they wanted. They could only go in one day a year, and God designated what day they could go in there. And even then, God said what they had to wear, and what they had to bring, what they had to say, what they had to do. And if you don't do it that way, he'll kill you. So he's real, real particular. So then it shouldn't be any surprise when Jesus walks on the stage of human history and walks around saying things like, I am the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me. People get all upset about that and say, well, that's much too exclusive. You Christians, you people who believe that Jesus is the only way. You ought to be able to go to God any old way you want. But there's never a place in the Bible, reaching all the way back here to Exodus, there's never a place in the Bible where God just flings open the possibility that anybody can approach him any way, anytime they want. That's never been the way God works. God has always, always been particular and exclusive, and he has always said who approaches him and how and when and by what means and using what method and what sort of sacrifice has to happen first. So there's a great continuity in what Jesus has said, what the New Testament authors proclaim about his electing grace, about his predestination, about the particularity of the atonement. That all fits very, very well with the God that we're getting to know in his dealings with Israel. Got all that? Okay. So, chapter 24 starts with, then God said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, or Abihu, depending on which pronunciation you like, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Now, you're allowed to come up. Remember earlier, he said, all of Israel, stay out, build a fence, put up a border, don't let people come up on the mountain. Even a dog gets near the mountain while God is on it. He has to be driven through and killed. Now God says, okay, Moses, you and Aaron, your brother, his two kids, Nadab and Abihu, you can come up with 70 of the elders and worship on the mountain now, but still at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him. So God just took all of Israel and divided them into groups. There's all Israel, the people, they have to stay down there completely. Then there's the 70 elders with Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu. So 74 people can come up but worship at a distance. And then Moses alone gets to come all the way up to the top of the mountain. Now, what was so special about Moses that he got to come all the way to the top? Because God chose him. Because God said, you get to come up to the top. What was so special about the 70 elders?
Nothing.
Why did they get to come partway up?
God
chose them. God elected them. God said, you guys, you can come up. They're going to see a magnificent vision of God that they're going to be able to carry back down and tell people, we saw this great vision of God while we were up there on the mountain. Why do they get to see it? Because God chose to show it to them. Now, there are bound to be people at the foot of the mountain who are going to say, how come you got to go up on the mountain and see a vision? 70 of you got to go up on the mountain and see a vision. That's not fair. I want to see a vision of God. How come you 70? Do you think the 70 elders that were chosen were necessarily the best, the most righteous, the holiest? There's no indication that they were. They're just the 70 oldest guys, the elders, leaders in Israel. And so Moses is going to take those 70 up on the mountain with him. And to everybody else at the bottom of the mountain, it's not fair. They don't get to go up. They don't get to see the vision. Why can't they go up? Because God said don't. Because that's the way it works. So then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. This is what we've been reading for the last several weeks. All those rules, all those laws. Moses came and recounted it all. And all the people answered with one voice. And they said, all the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Because so far, this entire religious experience is about doing. It's about the law. Here are the rules. Here are the law. Do it. And they said, okay, we're going to do it. Well, that establishes the covenant. And that's why the language is going to keep coming up. The book of the covenant, the blood of the covenant, the ark of the covenant. In a few minutes, they're going to say it again. When they establish the covenant, when the blood of the covenant is sprinkled on them, they're going to say, everything God said, we're going to do. This is an agreement, a two-sided conditional agreement. And they've accepted the terms and said, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. We're definitely going to do it. Even though God has said, now, if you don't do it, there's going to be a lot of trouble for you. They, oh, no, don't worry about it. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. Watch them exercise their will. Did they do it?
No.
No. First generation of Israel for the next 40 years marching through the wilderness, God's going to scatter the bones of the entire first generation because they don't do it. Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Now, what are those words? What words of the Lord are we talking about there?
Law of Moses.
Yeah, the law, everything we've heard so far that constitutes the law, the Ten Commandments that we heard, he's written all of this down so far. Then he arose early in the morning and he built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. Is there a particularity in that? Right, so when he builds the altar with the 12 columns and they sacrifice on that altar, who are they sacrificing for? The 12 tribes of Israel. Now, we're going to see this a lot. We're not going to get to it tonight, but when we get to the particular clothing that the priest has to wear, he's going to wear two onyx stones in golden ouches, they're called. Probably because when you put them on, you go, ouch, is probably why. They're shoulder gear that have two stones, and on each of the stones is written six of the tribes, six on this shoulder, six on this shoulder, as a burden on the shoulders of the high priest when he goes into the holiest place. But over his breast, over his heart, it specifically says to cover his heart with it, is a golden square plate with 12 precious stones, each one with the name of one tribe of Israel. So they're a burden on his shoulders, they're in gold and precious jewels over his heart, and he has to wear that once a year when he goes in on the Day of Atonement. So who's he in there atoning for?
Israel.
Israel. This is really, really easy now, isn't it? Because as we've been driving home over and over again, everything we're reading here is a covenant between God and Israel. So Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Verse 5, he sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood from those peace offerings, from the bulls. He took half of the blood and he put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. This is something we're going to see a lot as well. Every piece of furniture, and even the high priest himself, are going to be marked with blood, sacrificial blood, peace offering, sin offering blood, to consecrate everything that goes inside the temple. Blood was the method for this consecration. And do you know what I mean when I say consecration? Setting it aside for God's exclusive use. Once it's been consecrated to God, it can't be used for any common purpose. This is God's stuff now. So he took half the blood and he put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant. Now, what book of the covenant are we referring to there? Everything he just wrote down. He wrote down everything God said. Right? So not just the Ten Commandments, but the Ten Commandments and all those rules that we've been reading through for the last several weeks. Everything from if you see your enemy's donkey wandering from home. You got to send him back home. You got to take him back. And then all of the Sabbath rules. And then also the Ten Commandment rules and the killing rules and the not bearing false witness rules and the don't have any other idols. And when I take you into the land, make sure that you don't intermingle with those people and worship their idols. All those rules collectively are called the Book of the Covenant. So every one of those rules constitutes a piece of the covenant, right? Because it's far too easy for us to say, well, okay, Jim, if I'm going to admit that God created a covenant with Israel, I'm going to say that the religious rules or the ceremonial rules were part of that covenant, done away with in Christ for the new covenant. But there's no distinction made here. Moses received a bunch of rules. We just read them all. And then he wrote them all down. And then it's called the Book of the Covenant. So Moses took the Book of the Covenant and he read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, this is now the second time, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and he sprinkled it on the people. Now, you got to put flesh and blood on this for a moment. These people were not carrying porta showers with them anywhere. And they're traveling through a desert. And it's dusty, and it's sandy, and it's dirty. And the people collectively are gathered before Moses. And several bulls have been killed there at the foot of the mountain. And the blood has been collected, and half of all that blood is collected in basins. Now, for those of you who have ever worked around blood, you know it doesn't take long before blood starts to smell bad. Basins full of blood, and he starts splattering blood on the people. There's nowhere to go wash that off right away. There's no quick shower you're going to run through. They're at the foot of Mount Sinai. Now think about it for a moment. Carol, you come walking by. I'll be Moses. You be a child of Israel. And you come walking by in that escaped slave mode. You've gone through periods of struggling for food. You've gone through struggling for water. It's enough to eat and drink every day out there in the desert. Any less, get a bar of soap and a good wash. And you're part of the group that has said, all that God said, we're going to do. And I dip into that basin of blood, probably using some hyssop or something, and I splat all over you. Precisely. Why do you think God would do such a thing?
Does it symbolize?
It does symbolize. What does it symbolize?
Jesus.
Ultimately, Christ's blood. That blood is the means, sacrificial blood, sin offering, peace offering blood, is the blood that reconciles between man and God. And they had to wear that blood. They walked around with that blood splattered on them. Yes, sir.
This particular passage is used as a proof text for paedo baptism.
Probably because they're saying the children were probably included there.
They were in the arms and they got splattered too.
Isn't that interesting? I had never heard that particular verse used as a proof text for paedo baptism, but I can see where they would get that in their desperate search for proof. I can see how they would reach all the way to that. But put flesh and blood on it. Let's say you were a mother carrying a baby. Mm-hmm. Splat! Blood all over you. That's graphic stuff.
It sure is.
But God is making a graphic point. For sin comes death. The wages of sin is death. And when you sin, something must die. It's either going to be you or it's going to be a sacrifice in your place.
Which would be good with the babies in your arms, and something must die. Your baby, it sins also.
Right, right. I would make the argument that that doesn't prove paedobaptism. It proves infant depravity. There was no age of accountability. There was no, separate everybody up till 13. They don't need the blood on them. I would say if you got to splatter the babies, it's because the babies are sinful. Just because I'm argumentative theologically. When you sin, something has to die. And it's either going to be you or it's going to be a substitute. And that's why it's so important what kind of blood this was. This was sin offering and peace offering blood that was splattered on them. Now, when they were taken out of Egypt, on the night that they were taken out of Egypt, what did they have to put on their door?
Blood.
Blood of a lamb. Blood of a spotless, unblemished young lamb. A lamb that they had to keep in their house for a couple days, which is even crueler. Because little baby lamb, you get to know the little lamb, you get to love the little lamb. The children get to know him like a pet. Everybody, oh, little lamb, little lamb. That night, dad's responsible for hanging little lamb up by his back legs and slicing his throat. That's graphic. That had to be hard on the children. But if they didn't do it, that night, death came. If they did do it, then when the death angel passed through Egypt and saw the blood, everybody inside was safe. Why was everybody inside safe? Because the blood was sufficient. The blood did its job. The blood kept the death from going inside the house where the people were that had killed the lamb and put the blood on the door. Same thing happening here. God's making sure these people understand that for sin comes death, and the only way to reconcile your sinfulness is with blood, and he's doing it so graphically here that he's splattering ox blood on people. But then what does Moses call that blood? Remember, they've twice now said, all that the Lord has spoken, we're going to do. We're going to be obedient. So Moses took blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, behold, the blood of the covenant. That's what that blood did. That established that covenant. Now, by the way, we're in the new covenant. How was our covenant established? Through blood. Through the blood of Christ. And the blood of Christ is fully sufficient and fully efficient so that everybody's saved by, everybody covered by, every sin atoned for in that blood. It fully accomplished what it had to do. I mean, if the blood of a lamb could keep death away in Egypt, if the blood of oxen was enough to establish a covenant between Israel and God, then certainly the blood of the Son of God is fully efficient to accomplish what God intends to accomplish in this covenant. So it's all about blood. God's teaching back here that it's going to take blood to separate you, to pay for you, to redeem you. The blood of a sacrifice is necessary. And that's why the writer of Hebrews will pick it up and say, you know, the blood of bulls and the blood of goats was never sufficient ultimately to pay for sin. But Christ, in his one sacrifice, fully redeemed his people and sat down. Something that the priests, we're going to see, never get to do. They never get to sit down. If you're working in the tabernacle in the wilderness, you never get to sit down. There's a lot of furniture in the tabernacle. Just no chairs. No chaise lounge. No lazy boy recliner lounger. Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. So the book of the covenant, which is everything he received up on the mountain, all the stuff we read, the book of the covenant are the words that establish the covenant, that is established with the blood of the covenant. You getting a feel for the covenant thing yet? Notice that Moses said, this is the covenant that God made with you. You is the people who have the blood sprinkled on them. This covenant is not made with anybody but Israel. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they beheld God, and they ate, and they drank. And that's all Moses says about it. I want more detail. At least at the beginning of Ezekiel, we get to hear about the wheels and the eyes and the angels with the wings that touch flying in one direction. Here, they go up and they see God sitting on his throne. Very much like Isaiah. getting to see God high and lifted up. But the imagery is always consistent. Even in the book of Revelation, we hear about the glass sea out in front of God. This same kind of language, that he sits surrounded by this pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky. Sounds a lot like a sea of glass to me. The same kind of language as people grapple to describe the splendor that God showcases himself in. And they sat and ate and drank. Now the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandments that I have written for their instruction." So there's a reason for him to come up. Moses wrote all the rules down in a book, the Book of the Covenant. Now God says, "Come up and I'm going to give you stone tablets that have the commands and the law on them." And then he's going to put them in a box called the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 13 says, "So Moses arose with Joshua, his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. But to the elders he said, 'Wait here for us until we return to you, and behold, Aaron and Hur are here with you, and whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them.' Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. And the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. And to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. And Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Now Israel gets a lesson in patience, because they know that Moses has been told to go up to the top of the mountain. But from Israel's perspective, it's all fire up there. And Moses just went up into the fire. And he's gone for 40 days and 40 nights. Which is why they decide, well, I guess Moses is done. Perhaps a golden calf would be a good idea. Chapter 25. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me." Isn't that interesting? God gives them the law. They say, "Okay, we agree. Let's make a covenant." Moses establishes the covenant. Book of the covenant, blood of the covenant. God says, "Give me an offering." I was watching the other night on one of the learning history / we make stuff up channels. And I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? Was that my outside voice? Should have held that in. And it was a 2-hour special featuring a British fella who for years has been chasing the Ark of the Covenant. He would like to find the Ark of the Covenant. And he has several different theories. And I got to the end of the 2 hours and I went, "I want my 2 hours back." But part of his theory was that whenever the Ark of the Covenant is finally discovered, that it's not going to look like what we expect it to look like, because we think it's going to be a gold box. And he said, it's probably going to be a wood box. He goes into some of the little Middle Eastern shops where people are plating wood with different kinds of metals, and he shows how thin, with a paintbrush, you can plate on metal onto wood, as if Israel 3,400 years ago was using paintbrushes and modern plating techniques. But he said it's probably just a very, very light layer of gold on the wooden box, and over time that gold would have broken away, rusted away. What we're probably looking for is a wooden box. That was his theory. We're looking for a wooden box. We are not looking for a gold box. And part of his argument was, as stunning as this is, part of his argument was Israel were slaves who departed quickly out of Egypt. Where were they going to get the amount of gold it would take to cover a golden box? Where were they going to get that kind of gold?
So somebody's looking for the Ark of the Covenant that's never read the Bible?
Obviously.
Precisely. That's my thinking.
He looks in the Bible, sees all the golden plates and the opal shoulders.
Well, that's the point, is that it's not just a gold box God's going to require.
Right.
It's going to be gold silverware and gold plates, and it's going to be stuff of polished brass, and it's going to be a golden head plate, and it's going to be a golden breastplate, and it's a lot of gold that God is going to require. But more importantly, we're now going to prove that everybody in this room is more biblically adept than the expert on the History Learning We Make Stuff Up channel. Where did Israel get the gold to do everything God's about to require?
Egypt.
In Egypt, exactly. God even said, now Moses, tell them to borrow from their neighbors because you're leaving tonight. So get gold and get raiment and get what you can get because you're leaving tonight. And then God drowned their debtors. It was a great deal.
And then when you think about, let's make stuff up, but you think about all the treasures we find of Egypt, and their gold didn't wear off over
sure
here.
Didn't.
Right, yeah, the gold still exists on, and by the way, these were the slaves
who made all that. Right.
Yeah, so would they have any skill in making things out of gold and brass?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what they've been taught to do. Right. Which is why God's going to very specifically in a minute say, get the craftsmen and have them start making stuff. Because they already know how to do it. They did it in Egypt, and it still looks good to this day in Egypt.
Yeah.
You know, when they went into the pyramids, they found in some of the inner chambers of the pyramids writing on the walls in a form of paint that is 3,000 years old and still looks good. It's still there. You can still read it. It's all still on the walls. We can't make a paint that'll take four good winters. And they made paint that lasted 3,000, 4,000 years. So I'm guessing, considering that they had the wealth of Egypt when they left, and they had all the skill to create, I'm thinking this guy's wrong.
Doesn't he also think that God wouldn't have protected it? I mean, so it's somewhere.
It is somewhere. It exists somewhere. Yeah. God says, take up an offering, which makes no sense whatsoever if this guy's theory was true and that these were just impoverished slaves wandering through the desert. What was God asking for? Bring me a contribution. Oh, that's right, they're broke. Oh, I should have thought ahead. God did think ahead. He told them to take all that stuff from the Egyptians because he knew he was going to require an offering to build all this stuff. So they're able to. Now, by the way, it'll take us a few weeks to get to the actual offering, but when Moses comes down off the mountain and starts this offering, it's the only place in the whole Bible where you ever find an offering that becomes too much. And Moses ends up having to say, okay, we're good, you can stop giving now. Because God so moved on their hearts to do his will to build his tabernacle, and they were so enriched by what they brought with them out of Egypt, that they gave and gave and gave and gave until Moses said, we're good. We got plenty now. It's the only place that happens in the Bible. Probably the only place it's happened in the history of the church, too, where anybody's ever said, okay, we're good. All right, enough with the money. Tell the sons of Israel, says verse 2, tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him, you'll raise my contribution. Isn't that interesting? Now, he's going to later get into the tithes. He's already gotten into the first fruits. Bring the first of your wine. Bring the first of your grain. You're going to come see me 3 times a year. You're going to bring your stuff. He's going to get into all the mandatory giving, the mandatory tithes. But for this particular offering, for the tabernacle, he says, let every man whose heart moves him. That sounds a lot like Paul writing the escape clause to the Corinthians, doesn't it? Let every man give according as he determines in his heart. And yet we're going to see later on in the book of Exodus that God is going to move on their hearts to bring him an offering. And God says, and let every man who's moved in his own heart bring me an offering. And then God makes sure that he gets a more than sufficient offering because he's sovereign. And this is the contribution which you are to raise from them. Gold and silver and bronze and blue and purple and scarlet material, fine linen. I want goat hair, ram skins dyed red. I want porpoise skins. I want acacia wood. We need oil for lighting, spices for the anointing oil, and for the fragrant incense. I want onyx stones and setting stones for the ephod and for the breastplate. And let them construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them. That was a pretty specific offering request, wasn't it? Here's what I want. I want all this. Now, the only way he could require that from Israel, or let's say request that from Israel, is if he knows Israel actually has that. So these were not impoverished slaves. These were people out in the wilderness who had all this wealth, and the wealth was no help to them. What good is gold when you can't find water? Look at all the onyx stones I got, but man, I'm starving to death. A lot of wealth doesn't help you when you need daily necessities. Verse 9, well, let's back up. Let them construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them according to all that I am going to show you as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furniture, just so you shall construct it. So God's real, real specific, and he's saying, bring all that. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to have them build me a place of meeting, the tent of meeting, a tabernacle where we can meet, a temporary dwelling where we can meet. But I'm going to make it portable. Everything we make, we're going to be able to pick up on sticks and carry. And we're going to put up a tent that can be closed down and carried to the next place and built up again and reconstructed again. And that's part of what it means to have a tabernacle. That's why in the Feast of Tabernacles, it's also called the Feast of Booths, because the Israelites would make temporary dwellings. Sometimes they would leave the city and make their dwellings. Sometimes they'd put them on their rooftop. But for the period of the Feast of Booths, they had to live in temporary dwellings. And so they would take their dwelling that they had made at home, they'd bring it to Jerusalem, and they would stay in their temporary dwelling. And that's why it's so interesting that John would write that Jesus, the Son of God, tabernacled among us. The King James and some of the other translations unfortunately translated that, he came and he dwelt among us. But the actual word that John used was, he came and he tabernacled among us. He built a temporary dwelling and lived among his people. It's really interesting language, so that we can see what all those Feasts of Tabernacles were leading up to, which, by the way, when you get to Zechariah speaks of a distant future that we haven't seen yet. All the Gentiles are going to keep one of Israel's feasts every year. Do you know which one it is?
Feast of Tabernacles.
The Feast of Tabernacles is required of all the Gentiles someday. That hasn't happened yet. So this whole tabernacle concept's real important, and God is laying out the foundations of that in saying, now you're going to build me a tent of meeting. And then I'm going to tell you very specific instructions about how to make this tent of meeting. And then he says, it's a pattern, it's a structure, and you have to make it exactly according to my pattern. Now turn over to the book of Hebrews for a moment, the New Testament. Keep your finger there in Exodus and go over to Hebrews 8. Hebrews chapter 8. Right at the top of that chapter. Everybody there? Now the main point in what has been said is this. This is chapter 8, verse 1. We do have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, and hence it is necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle. For God said, see that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown to you in the mountain. But now he, Christ, has obtained a more excellent ministry, by as much as he also is the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. So the writer of Hebrews reaches back to chapter 25 here and says, the reason that Moses was told, now remember to keep the pattern, follow the pattern. Whatever I tell you, do it exactly according to the pattern. And the reason is because the writer of Hebrews said he was creating earthly images of heavenly things. So as we look at the tabernacle, and we look at the furniture, and we look at how it's built and how it's established, and the holy place and the tent of meeting, as we look at those things, we have to remember that they're patterned specifically to teach us heavenly things. Got that? Okay. We are back in Exodus 25. Verse 9, according to all that I'm going to show you as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of the furniture, just so you shall construct it. And they shall construct an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, 1.5 cubits high. Now, there are plenty of folk who have tried to figure out exactly what those dimensions are. Some of the notes in some of your Bibles might take an educated guess. Do you have in your footnotes a guess at the size?
I got 3.75 feet by 2.25 feet.
So 3.75 feet, about like yay? About 3.75 by about 2.25. So we're not talking about a particularly large box. And if you get some sense of how large that box is, you have some sense of how large the stones were that Moses brought down, because they fit in that box. And God already made the stones he's going to give to Moses, so he knows how big a box to make. So he's telling Moses, make the box exactly this big. Verse 11, and you shall overlay it with pure gold inside and out. You shall overlay it, and you shall make a gold molding around it. And you will cast 4 gold rings for it and fasten them on its 4 feet. And 2 rings shall be on the one side of it, and 2 rings shall be on the other side of it. And you will make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. And you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark with the poles. Now, why would you need the poles to carry the ark? Because you can't touch the ark. Big rule. Can't touch the ark. Even if it's on the back of a wagon, and the wagon jostles, and you reach out to stabilize it, no good, people die. You can't touch the ark. Once it's made, and once the blood is sprinkled on it, and once God has come down and met there, that is a holy object. And being completely holy and consecrated to God, men can't touch it, or they would defile it. And God is real, real serious about it. So he says, now make rings and put rings on both sides of it and get 2 poles to slide through the rings and then pick it up, because it's got to be portable, because we're going to move. For the next 40 years, we're going to be moving around and you need to take this everywhere you go. By the way, you got to assume it's probably kind of heavy. That kind of size, and then the gold on it and stones inside it. Pretty heavy box. And yet Israel had to carry it around on their shoulders like a burden. Verse 14, you shall put the poles into the rings on the side of the ark to carry the ark with them. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark, and they shall not be removed from it. And you shall put into the ark the testimony which I shall give you. And you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. What do your other translations have for mercy seat?
An atonement.
An atonement. Isn't that an interesting word? Kapareth is the word. It is a seal, a top, a lid that acts as a covering, because atonement is a covering. And the King James were the first translation to go with a seat of mercy or a mercy seat, which is just really interesting language. The NASB continued that idea, but what it means is a place of atonement, because that's going to be the place where the high priest can pour sacrificial blood and God will come down and meet between the wings of the angels on the Kapareth above the ark that contains the law. So inside the box of pure gold is the law, the covenant. That law that will kill you. That law that can't help you. But covering that law and keeping that law from killing you is a place to pour sacrificial blood where God will come and meet and make atonement. So God's been teaching the necessity of sacrifice and a God-established atonement for 1,400 years before Jesus walked on the planet. There was no new theology there. We are at verse 18. I had a junior moment. Sophomore moment. I'm younger than that. I had a sophomore moment. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. And you will make 2 cherubim, 2 angels of gold. Make them of hammered work and put them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. And make 1 cherub at 1 end and 1 cherub at the other end. And you'll make the cherubim of 1 piece with the mercy seat at its 2 ends. Now, that's quite a piece of craft work. It doesn't sound like he thinks these are unskilled laborers. And he wants all of this made of gold. Then the 2 angels, one on either end of the covering, he now describes what their wings are going to do. The cherubim shall have their wings spread upward, covering the mercy seat with their wings and facing one another. And the faces of the cherubim are to be turned toward the mercy seat. And you shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and in the ark you will put the testimony which I shall give you. And there I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in commandments for the sons of Israel. So God's making arrangements and saying, now, as long as Israel remains my covenant people, I'm going to need to communicate with you. I'm going to need to be able to speak to you. And once a year, I'm going to come down and be in your midst, establishing you as my people and reminding you yearly that I'm here, I'm in your midst, I'm right here. But in order for me to do that, there are requirements. And you have to make figures of angels looking toward one another and looking toward the place where we're going to meet. And you have to pour blood in that meeting place. And then the cloud of God is going to come down and it's going to be there so that the high priest can make atonement for Israel and God can intercede for Israel once a year for their sins so they continue being his people. And all they got to do is do it his way. That's all you got to do. He's going to be real specific. Here's what you got to wear. Here's what you got to bring. Here's what the furniture looks like. So I got to just do it my way and I'll continue showing up in your midst. Do they do it?
No.
No. Which is why they end up having to tie a cord to the ankle of the high priest, because if he goes in there and God's not happy, God kills him, and then nobody can go in and get him, so you got to drag him out by the rope you tied around his feet. God's also going to say, tell you what, let's put belts. He doesn't use the phrase tell you what, but he does tell him what. He says, put bells, like little pomegranates, put bells all the way around the bottom, the hem of the robe of the high priest, and that way the people outside can hear the bells and they know he's still at it. If you don't hear the bells, pull the rope. He's done. All they got to do is do it his way. Then he says, this is very interesting, starting in verse 23, we're nearly done here tonight. And you're going to make a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long and 1 cubit wide and 1.5 cubits high. And you will overlay it with pure gold and make a gold border around it. This sure does sound like they got lots of gold, doesn't it? This does not sound like people who are scraping together a little bit of gold to lightly flake it over their wooden box. And you'll make for it a rim of a hand's breadth all around it. And you shall make a gold border for the rim around it. This is very ornate. This is a very pretty table. And you shall make 4 gold rings for it and put rings on the 4 corners which are on its 4 feet. And the rings shall be close to the rim as holders for the poles to carry the table. And you shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold, so that with them the table may be carried. And you shall make its dishes and its pans and its jars and its bowls with which you will pour out libations. You shall make all of them of pure gold. And you shall set the bread of the presence on the table before me at all times. We'll get into it later, but this is called the table of showbread. And it's called the table of showbread because the bread is there for show, which is really interesting. The bread is not there as a regular meal. It's not the first course. It is the show bread that must be set before God all the time, all the time. Now, every day, God's going to be giving them manna, bread from heaven. And every day, the priests have to make sure there's bread before God. And so Jesus is going to show up on the planet, walk around talking about bread and talking about being the bread of life, about being the bread that comes down from heaven. So this showbread's a very important concept. God is still teaching. God is still creating symbols. Then you shall make a lampstand of pure gold. The lampstand and its base and its shaft are to be made of hammered work. Its cups, its bulbs, and its flowers shall be of one piece with it. One piece of pure gold hammered into a lampstand. That's what God's requiring here. And 6 branches shall go out from its sides. 3 branches of the lampstand to one side, 3 branches of the lampstand to the other side. 3 cups shall be shaped like almond blossoms in the one branch, and a bulb and a flower. And 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms on the other branch, a bulb and a flower. So 6 branches going out from the lampstand. And in the lampstand, 4 cups shaped like almond blossoms, its bulbs and its flowers. And the bulb shall be under the first pair of branches coming out of it, and the bulb under the second pair of branches coming out of it, and a bulb under the 3rd pair of branches coming out from it for the 6 branches coming out of the lampstand. Their bulbs and their branches shall be of one piece with it. And all of it shall be one piece of hammered work of pure gold. Could you make that?
No.
These are some skilled people he's talking to. These are some craftsmen who can do that. Now, by the way, this is a menorah. You've probably seen it. Here, I can now get to embrace my art. A central stand, and then usually 3 branches like that. And to this day, menorahs are very common in Jewish households and Jewish temples. Well, that design is not random. It was God that created that design, though I'm betting that there are very few solid gold made of one piece menorahs floating around. But after all, he's God, and this is what he's demanded from them. So he has to assume they have the ability, the skill, and the wherewithal, and the gold to do this. Otherwise, it's pointless to demand it. Verse 37, then you will make its lamps, 7 in number, and they shall mount its lamps so as to shed light on the space in front of it. And its snuffers and their trays shall be of pure gold. The thing you use to snuff out, again, yeah, pure gold. I want pure gold for that. It shall be made from 1 talent of pure gold. Then with all its utensils, and see that you make them after the pattern for them which was shown to you on the mountain. Now, chapter 26 is about curtains. Then we're going to get into boards and sockets, and the veil and the screen, and then the bronze altar. Next week, we will start with the curtains of linen, and then we'll get into the separate curtains. That chapter is riveting because it is descriptions of curtains, which, you know, if there's any seamstresses in the group, you may find it fascinating but it is just very specific and descriptive of the kind of curtains they have to build for the outside walls, for the inside walls, for the covering across the top, for the tent of meeting. All of this is very specific. God leaves nothing, nothing up to them. He doesn't say, and then when it comes to the rings, Moses, just throw some rings together. Every minute detail, God takes the time to spell out. Say, make it like this. Make it exactly like this. Do it the way I said to do it. Because we're dealing with a very specific God who has always been very specific, who has never changed in his nature and character, and can say and does say, this is how you do things. You want to be with me? You want to be in heaven? You want redemption? You want that everlasting life? Okay, here's how you do it. And he's always been like that. And then if you don't do it his way, he doesn't go, you tried. Close enough. I know you meant to come to my son. You just ended up at Bhagwan Roshnish. But I know you meant well. God is always into the details, very specific, and constantly, constantly demonstrating his absolute right and authority to say to human beings, this is how you approach me. Don't do this any other way. And I just don't know why people think that when the new covenant came about, God changed. But with God, there is no variableness, no shadow of turning. Yes, the covenant changed. And yes, the real approach to him was demonstrated. It's through Christ and no other way. But in terms of the character of God and his absolute sovereign right and authority to say how you approach him, never changed. Nothing changed there. He still has the right to say, if you're going to approach me, this is how you do it. And he's always been that way. Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad that at some point in your life, you found out how to approach him?
Yes.
Because for all these years that Israel was walking around carrying this stuff on their shoulders, nobody in Australia ever found out what Israel knew. No red American Indians found out how to approach God. But Israel, for 1,400 years, had the advantage of knowing how to approach God. And God spoke to them, and God sent them prophets, and God sent them the Messiah. You can't point at Israel and go, those silly people, you wouldn't have been any better. I heard a preacher one time who was very proud of his, very arrogant about his, you know which arrogant preacher I'm talking about, who was very proud of his ability to maintain his own faith and rev up his own will. And he said one time, he was talking about how the 12 apostles, well, 11, you know, take Judas aside, how the 11 apostles all abandoned Jesus that night when he was tried and they are all scattered. And he made the point that when Jesus was on the cross, John was the only one down there, and how it must have broken Jesus' heart to look around and see that none of those that he'd been teaching for the 3.5 years, none of them were there. They should have rioted and come and stormed in there and tried to overthrow the guard and try to take Jesus down off there. None of them got in there and fought for Jesus. And he was so disappointed that none of them did. And then he had the audacity to say, I would have. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, no, you wouldn't have. Because Jesus told them that night they were all gonna scatter. Because that's exactly the way it had to be. He had to die outside the camp. He had to die alone. It was a work he had to do by himself. Nobody was there to help him. Nobody was there to mop up after him. Nobody was there to add to his work. It was something. Yeah, Peter took out his sword in the Garden of Gethsemane and Jesus said, it's not time to fight. Put away your sword. I could call legions of angels, but he had to do what he had to do. So none of us would have done any better. If you were out there marching with Israel and didn't have the Holy Spirit and didn't have the book and didn't know, you wouldn't do any better. You'd say, I'm gonna, but you wouldn't. Yeah, what?
None of us do any better today.
None of us do any better today.
Right.
Grace, 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 grace.
Everybody cuts us off on the interstate.
That's right. Oh, I know.
The preacher does save Jesus from the cross. What good does he think he's accomplishing?
Wasn't that a remark? You remember that.
Oh, yeah.
He said that the disciples should have gone in, fought the Romans, and tried to get him down off that cross. And I thought, that makes no theological sense at all. You don't want him off that cross. No, that's... Anyway. the ego of human beings. All right, good. We made some progress tonight. We finally got out of that big chunk of here's the rules, and now we're getting into here's the curtains. So we're moving there. So.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.